On Tech News Today, Facebook can now recognize you in pictures, even if your face isn't showing. Amazon's best product ever is now available to the public, and we'll tell you how to get artificial intelligence help in the kitchen for free. It's all coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Tuesday, June 23rd, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Warby Parker Eyewear. Get boutique, quality, classically crafted eyewear, including sunglasses, at revolutionary prices. For a free home try-on of five stylish frames of your choice, plus free three-day shipping, go to warbyparker.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin, and our co-anchor today is After Nine's content czar, Joe Panettiere. Hey, Joe, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Mike. And, you know, the irony of it is, though, today, I feel like I'm losing money on this show because every time I tune in, there's this sponsor where after the show, I go off and I start buying their products. So I'm running a net loss, but I'm getting a lot of great products here.
It's funny because I, of course, was a big fan of Twitch shows long before I started working here. And, you know, basically, I started buying all the stuff that Leo has been advertising over the last few years. And so now when I do shows with Leo, he's like, oh, well, here's this and this company and that company and this company. And I'm a heavy user of all of them. We have a great model here where we basically only advertise the products that we love and use. And so it's a great model. So, yeah. You're going to enjoy your Warby Parker glasses, I guarantee it.
They're going to go to my wife, actually. So okay. As soon as I heard that that plug, I said, oh, here's something for the next gift for the wife.
You'll appreciate it. Somebody who looks at startups and companies that do innovation, you'll pay attention to their, and I don't mean to do the ad yet, pay attention to the customer service. It's mind-blowing. Anyway, I'd love to hear your comments on that. Let's jump into the news. Facebook's face recognition technology has become so good that they can now identify you in pictures, even if your face is hidden from view. Aviva Rutkin is a reporter for New Scientist and joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to you, Aviva.
Hey, happy to be here.
Glad you're here. Now, how does Facebook do this? How can Facebook recognize people in pictures without even seeing their faces?
Well, you think about how are you able walking around on the street to recognize someone if maybe you only see the side of their face or the back of their head? It could be because they have a distinctive hairdo, because they tend to wear the same shirt all the time. Maybe they have a kind of unusual body shape. You know, all these things together are all clues that computers, too, can use to try to pick things out. And so what Facebook's done is in their AI lab, they've done they took 37,000 photos off of Flickr that were publicly available and developed a neural network that could go through and look at, okay, if I see the side at the front of your face, sure, that's easy enough. But what if you're looking down? What if you're partially cut off by someone? And basically trained it with 83% accuracy to identify people correctly.
Hey, Aviva, any clues in terms of how Facebook may monetize this or leverage it? I mean, it sounds like a gee whiz feature, but what might be the business model going forward?
Yeah, it's a great question. Right now, this is something that Facebook tells me is not used on their site. But one thing that we talked about that they could use it for is their new Moments app, which basically sorts through all your photos for you and says, oh, these look like you were all at your friend's wedding on this day. And there's your brother, there's the bride, and kind of pick out everyone and take some of the work out of it for you.
I'm curious that they used, what did you say, Flickr? It seems to me that Facebook would have access to plenty of people pics. Why do they use a site outside of Facebook?
You know, I think Facebook, ever since last year, especially when people heard about their emotional contagion study and got upset, you know, they're really a lot more sensitive now to what they should and should not be doing with the data on their network. And so, you know, if you go on Flickr, you can find specifically photos that people have said, these are publicly available, anyone can use them. Versus, you know, if they went through Facebook and scooped through some of your stuff, it might not be something that you wanted them to be developing their algorithm with.
Hey, are there any clues so far in terms of how this technology may compare to what the United States is up to and what the FBI is up to and other organizations within the U.S.?
I think it's probably not as good as some of the, you know, the FBI database or the other kinds of face algorithms that you already see out there. Facebook's algorithm, for example, that recognizes frontal faces, DeepFace, last year hit the 97% accuracy mark, which makes it about as good as you or me. This one still has a little bit of a way to go, but that may only be a matter of time and tinkering.
Now, I was intrigued by your article in several points, but one of those was that you actually suggested a way that this kind of technology could be used to protect your privacy. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, when I was speaking with the head of the AI lab there, Jan Lassoon, that was something that he came up with as a possible way that people could use it, I guess, for good, to be able to be alerted by an algorithm every time a picture of you goes up, even if it's kind of obscured or weird. Obviously, there's a lot of concern now about what the privacy implications are of algorithms like these. And so you could really, I guess, you know, it could really go either way. There's a lot more worries now, I think, than people crusading to use it. But it's an interesting idea.
Very interesting indeed. And it's just crazy that Facebook is at the leading edge of this. Aviva Hope Rutkin is at avivahoperutkin.com, as you might imagine, and on Twitter at RealAvivaHR. Thank you so much for joining us today, Aviva.
Thank you.
All right. Got a little bit of breaking news here for you. Today, as we have been doing this show, Facebook actually passed Walmart in terms of market capitalization on the stock market. So you heard it here first. Facebook is a more valuable company than Walmart. Very interesting. Well, we got some more news for you in just a sec, but first I want to talk to you about glasses, the best quality glasses you can get at very, very low prices. They have cracked the code on glasses, and I got news for you. I don't know how to break it to you, so I'm just going to break it to you. Summer's here already, so you're going to need some sweet sunglasses, and the place to get those sunglasses is at Warby Parker. These are made with the same high-quality materials that you find in the super expensive shops, but at revolutionary prices, and, you know, they're all styled after classic vintage frames, so you're going to love them. They look really, really cool. They don't look cheesy or poorly designed. They're very nicely designed glasses. And, you know, other companies keep the prices artificially high, $300, $400, $500, plus the cost of the lenses and all the rest. Glasses are so expensive, and so what people do is they get lower quality glasses. But you don't have to. Now, a lot of people don't know that Warby Parker sells progressive lenses. That's right. A lot of people like progressive lenses, and not only do they sell and offer progressive lenses, they offer the very best kind at very low prices. It's called a digital freeform lens. This is the most advanced progressive technology, and it's a digital app. Their digital application provides a larger field of vision. So instead of a very narrow, if you've ever worn progressives, you know, most progressive gives you this really tiny little narrow window of focus in the glasses. You have to look straight ahead. But where Warby Parker progressives give you a much wider, much larger field of vision. They're so comfortable where everything's in focus, whether you're looking at a computer or reading a book or looking off into the distance, whatever your prescription, their progressive lenses are going to make you very, very happy. And of course, all their glasses include anti-reflective, anti-glare coating, a hard case, and a cleaning cloth. This is such a great service. You've got to try Warby Parker, and you can do it with their free home try-on program. Just go to warbyparker.com/TNT, choose 5 pairs of glasses, and Warby will send them to you so you can try them on. They include a special frame box and a prepaid shipping label for easy return. Just simply choose the frames you want, enter the prescription details if needed, and Warby Parker takes care of the rest. And for every pair of glasses you purchase, Warby Parker sends a pair to someone who needs them. They partner with nonprofits like VisionSpring. So give Warby Parker a try for stylish new glasses, prescription or sunglasses at warbyparker.com/TNT. Get the free home try-on and get the 3-day shipping on your final frame purchase. That is free. And that's warbyparker.com/TNT. And we thank Warby Parker for their support of Tech News Today and for their fantastic glasses. BlackBerry missed first quarter expectations in today's earnings report. The company lost about $28 million for the quarter on revenue of $658 million. Spencer Jacob writes the Wall Street Journal's Head of the Tape column and joins us now to talk about BlackBerry. Welcome to you, Spencer.
Thank you.
Now, how is Wall Street responding to BlackBerry's earnings?
You know, the initial response in the pre-market was positive, and it was a bit of good news, then bad news, and then other bad news, and now the stock is down. The real kind of report card thing that people had been focusing on that I wrote about in my column, which, as usual, appeared ahead of the earnings, was people wanted to see what they were most focused on is what they got, because they were looking, this is companies trying to turn into a software company. And they viewed John Chen's target for this year as being super ambitious. And based on what they accomplished, they blew away all estimates in the first quarter on their software revenue. And so on that front, it was very, very positive. And that was even more important than how many cents they made or lost during the quarter. They want to see them making a credible transition to being a software company. On the other hand, that the handset revenue, which is an afterthought these days, you know, this company used to have over half of the handset market as recently as 2009. It's kind of amazing to think that has well under 1%. And that part of the puzzle was bad. But I think what was disappointing to people is that they were hoping to hear the company throw in the towel to some extent on handsets, and they didn't. And that view, the view on the street is that it's not a promising business. It's a drain on resources. They should just cut the cord. And, you know, and even though the products have been fairly well reviewed, the Classic and whatnot, they shouldn't be in that business because it's expensive and money losing. And that was the most disappointing thing in these numbers, that it mentioned more initiatives to cut costs and become more competitive in that business rather than saying, okay, you know, we're sticking a fork in it, we're done.
Hey, Spencer, what's your gut feeling on the device business in terms of how long they stick with this? Are you hearing any rumors that they may cut the cord? And are you sharing any other thoughts in terms of how they may turn the company around?
Well, I mean, I'm not specifically hearing rumors, but there were rumors in the last several weeks that they would potentially, you know, they would keep their security software, but ditch their operating system, which has been well received for Android and become basically another Android manufacturer with enhanced corporate security. And they didn't say that today. So this was the opportunity for them to come out and say it. And that's why people were disappointed on Wall Street. There's a great deal of pessimism. And you know, although the company's not in danger of running out of money, I mean, they've stabilized themselves financially. The future is seen as enterprise software, and the failure to even though the numbers were a lot worse than was expected for the handset business, the failure to say, okay, we're giving in another year, or we're cutting the cord, or we're investing less in this business. They didn't say any of those things. They announced yet another manufacturing agreement with a Taiwanese firm to cut costs. But it's believed, they don't break it out, but it's believed that they're losing quite a bit of money on the handset business today. And there's no light at the end of the tunnel there based on what we saw today.
I think people are frustrated with BlackBerry because, I mean, with all the emphasis on security these days, they should have a big advantage there with the theoretical potential to do something unique in the enterprise. I mean, right now, Apple's running away with the enterprise phone market, even though they don't really try as hard as BlackBerry does. That may be a mischaracterization. They also have the market locked up for physical keyboards. Yes, it's a minority of users who want physical keyboards, but they own it, theoretically. Why can't BlackBerry succeed with all of the advantages that they have?
You know, it's a bit of a mystery, and that really tells you that, I mean, that handsets, the handset business, is just as much consumer-driven and about fashion as anything else. You know, when the iPhone first came out, and BlackBerry had some 53% of the market at the time, of the smartphone market, admittedly, it was a much smaller market, they laughed. They said, oh, no push email? Come on. I mean, you know, no enhanced security, no keyboard. People are not going to go for this. Yet the iPhone is where it is today, and BlackBerry is just a footnote at the bottom of the market. They're not a serious competitor to anyone. So it really is not enough to, and that's, you know, there's a very long history in the technology business. It's really not enough to have a superior product once you have lost critical mass. You know, whether it's Betamax or whatever else you want to mention. I mean, the iPhone has succeeded, has caught on, and people don't value a physical keyboard. The virtual keyboards have gotten so much better. Predictive text has gotten so much better. So they've solved some of the problems. And then individuals care less about security. And then you have firms like BlackBerry and like other firms who are offering third-party solutions to companies like the Wall Street Journal. You know, we have encryption. I don't know if it's at the level actually that BlackBerry offers, but everything's encrypted and goes through the corporate network. And I'm speaking to you on my iPhone 5S, and I assume that there's some level of security.
All right. Well, you know, ahead of the tape is a great name for a column, but do they still have tape? Is there tape?
No, they don't. I think ticker tape was phased out in the 1960s. So it's a really, really archaic name, but people still know what it is, you know, and, you know, that's a good point. Ahead of the, I don't know what you would
exactly
call it, ahead of the blip.
We have to use the analog metaphors because in digital, it's just, you know, what are you going to say? And you're right. Everybody knows exactly what your column is about. It's a great name. It's a great column. Thank you, Spencer, so much for joining us today. Spencer Jacobs at WSJ.com and on Twitter at Spencer Jacob. Jacob is spelled J-A-K-A-B. Thanks again for joining us today, Spencer.
Thank you.
All right. A company called Insensi unveiled today a new way for families to stay connected. It's called the Illy. Liam Bugar is the editor of a blog called Rude Baguette and joins us now. Liam, how are you doing? Thank you for joining us. Now, before we get into the Illy, can you tell us about Rude Baguette? I mean, I've encountered a lot of baguettes and they're all pretty nice. What is Rude Baguette all about?
Yeah, thanks for having me here. So Rude Baguette is an English language tech blog covering the French market. So the baguette is France and Rude is probably how we talk about it.
Nice. Wonderful. Well, if you can tell us about this Illy product. It sounds simple at first, but when you get into it, it's actually a little complex. What is the Illy?
Definitely. So Illy is a product that just came out of a company called Insensi, as you mentioned, founded by a French co-founder, which is why we covered it today. Elon, who is living in New York. And Illy is, I called it Slack for families. And I think this is a subject that we've seen a lot of people try to tackle, this idea of how do you create a familial network. We've seen pseudo telephones come out for children that allow you to only call families. We've seen other products like the Tribee come out, which is a sort of refrigerator magnet where you can really quickly call one, two, or three numbers and send quick messages. It's a sort of It kind of reminds me of this sort of AOL-esque internet where you have access to all the things that the internet should do, but without having the sort of 4chan, Reddit, dark web side of things. And so it gives kids the ability to contact their grandma, their aunt, their mother. And it has an always-on feature where you don't have to open an app to receive a call. It just always works.
So Liam, can you clarify for us, especially for our listeners who are not watching video right now and seeing the video roll, is this an app that runs on third-party devices or is this a brand new integrated hardware software device?
Definitely. So it's a little bit of both. And that's actually kind of what I liked about it. So one of the things they say is you can replace your home telephone with this. I don't know people who still have a home telephone, but if you still have one, you could replace it. So it does have a hardware standalone a tablet format. Which is just a standalone hardware that'll come with all the Illy functionality. But if you already have an iPad or an iPhone or an Android or a desktop computer, you can also download the Illy apps and add them on. And so all the Illy platform can communicate with itself either via their designated hardware, which obviously will have only Illy functionality, or via your given iPad, tablets, iPhone, and things like that.
Why have the dedicated hardware unit? Why not just use existing tablets, phones, and apps?
Well, I think one of the big things that they're trying to push is, one, not every child has an iPad.
Yet.
I know, and yet, or an iPhone or other tablets. I know that, for example, in my family's house, they share tablets. And so the idea of having a dedicated device that isn't Facebook and a phone, which means that you can answer a phone call from grandma without bugging your sister, I think has a lot of value. And I think it goes along the same lines of, one, we're multiplying devices every single day. I don't think there's this idea of lit or illy. But at the same time, we have this need to have a more verticalized experience. So I think it goes a little bit along the lines of the connected home experience without necessarily saying, here's the dedicated device that you're going to connect your home with. It's like connecting families.
Hey, Liam, what about pricing and availability on this? Are there any clues as to when you can actually purchase it? Is it available now, for instance, or is this just a teaser alert for something that's forthcoming?
So the product is currently available for pre-order for $199. You can check it out at illy.co, ily.co. And I think they're planning on launching or revealing more details in the fall. So I'd say it's somewhere in between a teaser and an actual launch. So you can order it today. I know a lot of my friends, especially my friends who have families, have already ordered theirs. And I think $199 is a pretty decent discount for a fully functional iPad, you know, tablet on its own, let alone a tablet dedicated to the family.
It's kind of interesting. In the mid-century of the mid-last century, the video phone was the future. In the year 2000, we're all speaking video phones, the Jetsons and all the rest. And now it's here at last, and people, you know, the general public's like, eh, whatever. But hopefully this will help a lot of families stay in touch and keep the kids safe and give the kids a way to connect without basically handing a seven-year-old a phone.
Definitely.
Liam Bougar is at rubegat.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Liam Bougar, which is L-I-A-M-B-O-O-G-A-R. Thank you so much for joining us today, Liam.
Thank you very much. All right.
Microsoft's $100 million acquisition of the calendar app Sunrise in February, well, it seems a little strange. The app had no revenue and duplicated features Microsoft already offered in other products, so why did they buy it? The Information's Stephen Nellis wrote about the acquisition and joins us to shed some light on this mystery. Welcome to you, Stephen.
Hi, glad to be here, Mike.
I'm so glad you're here. Because this has to be cleared up. You wrote that Microsoft bid high and moved fast to acquire Sunrise as if it was some kind of technology they absolutely needed, but they clearly didn't need the technology. What did your sources tell you about why Microsoft bought this company?
Well, I think at least one element of it was that there was demonstrated interest from Dropbox, which is a potential competitor to Microsoft in a lot of ways. If you'll remember back to 2013, Dropbox acquired a company called Mailbox. There was an email app. They are testing a word processing app called Notes right now and generally trying to move into the productivity space where Microsoft was dominant in the desktop age but has kind of struggled to gain a lot of traction in the mobile age. So the way to think about this is not so much that Microsoft needs technology. They have thousands and thousands of engineers who can write code all day long. What they're really looking for, though, is the ability to engage users with a product that people use because they want to use it, not because they've been told to use it at work. And that is honestly worth more than, you know, a few hundred million bucks is nothing compared to losing the tens of billions of dollars that these core products like Outlook, Skype, and all the others actually bring in. So what they're really after here is just the design talent. And you know, I think the sign that Dropbox had also been interested was just a sign that this was an app that had some real momentum and the potential to really grab a lot of users if kind of fed into a system like Dropbox or Microsoft where they have hundreds of millions, if not billions, of existing users.
So whatever happened to Sunrise? I mean, fast forward to today, what has Microsoft done with this technology?
Well, that's the interesting thing here and what's a little bit different about these acquisitions. So if you look, Sunrise has continued to develop technology. They put out an Apple Watch app so that you can manage your calendar from your Apple Watch. They've continued to add features here and there like integrations with to-do lists and you know things where you can send people what your availability is and other things. So they've continued to work on technology just like some of these other apps like Acompli, the team that's now basically the Outlook mobile email app. You know, one of the things that is a bit different here is Microsoft is bringing these folks into the organization and basically tasking them specifically with just developing mobile product and continuing to do what they do. So it's not a situation like you've seen in some other acquisitions, like some of the enterprise acquisitions around security and things where, you know, they basically take that, integrate it as a feature into the main product line, and then, you know, the teams sort of stay there for a few years and then disband. These teams, as far as we can tell, are continuing to introduce features, continuing to introduce product, and sort of becoming the face of a very big company, at least in the mobile space.
Now, Stephen, you also interviewed Microsoft Chief Experience Officer Julie Larson Green. For starters, what is a Chief Experience Officer?
Well, she has it's a little bit of an odd job title, but essentially it boils down to unifying the entire user experience, the look and the feel of the apps, the way you interact with them across Microsoft's entire software suite, which includes everything from Office, so you're talking Excel, PowerPoint slides, all the way to the Bing search engine and all the way to Skype, using Skype on your phone. And then these new apps too. So it's actually a very difficult challenge because a lot of these, Office has a 30-year history. Some of these things that were brand new, like the Outlook app and the calendar app and the to-do list. So they've got to figure out how to harmonize those things and make them all into an experience that helps you get stuff done. Sort of the way that you used to with Google services. I mean, if you think about where Google is at the moment with, you know, Google Now, Google Maps, and the Gmail and Inbox applications, the whole point is that you can access multiple things from one to the other. Wherever you are, you can get things done when you need to get them done. And that's something that is really top priority for Microsoft, right? They want you to be able to no matter what specific app you're in or what product you're using, if there's something that you might be likely to do, for example, schedule an appointment from an email, well, then they want to make sure that you have some calendar functionality, not all of it, but enough of it to get done what you need to get done when you're answering an email from somebody about, hey, what time can you meet? Now, that doesn't mean they won't have a standalone calendar app for people who need to do other things, like, for example, manage a big group meeting. Those are features that might be in the full-fledged calendar app. But the whole point is they want to take all these experiences and think through them instead of from the historical standpoint of, hey, we have these four apps that make up Office, Word, Outlook, PowerPoint, and Excel, and each one of them has to do X, Y, Z. And think about it more from the angle of, okay, what do people actually do? How can we help them do that? And how can we get them using this stuff? To hear Microsoft talk about daily active users and talk about putting users in touch with engineers directly to give feedback on apps to engage people, that's measuring stuff the way that, you know, Google or Apple or some of the big consumer companies measure stuff. And it's absolutely vital for them to do that because, you know, while they still have a lot of traction now, if you look at where things are headed, everything's going mobile and they're coming from behind in terms of getting traction with consumers, right? Not just people using them because they have to at work, but people using them because they want to make their lives easier. They just have to get some traction there if they want to continue to be as dominant as they have with some of those tools.
Very interesting. Stephen Nellis is at theinformation.com. You can read both of those articles at theinformation.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Stephen Nellis. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
All right. Well, in product update news, the Amazon Echo has been invitation only for select Amazon Prime members, and there was a long waiting list. But starting July 14th, the product goes on sale at last to the general public, and the price is $179.99. Joe Panettiere, my wife bought me this product for Father's Day over the weekend, and I'm super excited. It's going to arrive in, I don't know, a week or two. Can't wait till it gets there. My son has two of them. Well, he owns one, and he just ordered a second one, and he absolutely loves it. Are you tempted, or do you own this product?
I don't own it yet. I'm an Amazon Prime member, and my wife is addicted to Amazon in terms of just getting things done and purchased. So there's a good possibility this will be in our home soon. We've got three sons, and birthdays are coming up, et cetera. So I'm really interested. What did your son find so interesting about Echo so far?
Well, one of the things that he loves about it as a geek is that it is software upgradable. So this isn't a product like a phone where you get it and you're excited about it now, and in a year you're like not that excited about it, and in a year later it's completely obsolete and you have to get a new one. You can have this for years and years and years, and as Alexa, which is the software intelligent agent behind it, improves, it'll be updated. So it'll be software updated. It's just a speaker and a microphone and a Wi-Fi connection.
But it could turn into Hal someday. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, it will turn into Hal. I'm sorry, I can't open the bathroom door, Dave. But it's a really great product, and he loves the psychology of having a physical object with a really rich speaker in the room that he can just talk to, and get simple answers, and it just becomes a natural interaction, unlike, you know, the virtual assistants that exist in our browsers or on our phones or wherever. It's just nice to have an appliance just right there plunked in the middle of his apartment. And he loves it. And I've done a review on it, actually, for Before You Buy here on Twit. And I loved it as well. It's really great. And I'm shocked that Amazon beat both Apple and Google to the punch with a device like this.
So. Yeah, well, you know, I really respect Amazon in terms of the fact that they keep on experimenting. And yes, Google experiments a lot. I don't think Apple experiments quite so publicly compared to Google and Amazon. But Amazon really is the risk taker. I mean, think about the Fire Phone. I mean, that thing absolutely bombed. It flamed out. But they tried.
No pun intended.
Yeah, exactly. Well, sort of. Maybe I was thinking ahead. But anyway, basically, Jeff Bezos keeps on trying and trying and delivering something new and innovative. Something sticks, some things don't. I got a feeling this one's going to stick.
I literally think this is the best product they've ever come out with. Far more interesting than their readers, which some of which are very, very good. Definitely better than the phone or the TV set. I just think this is a great product. And not only is it a great product, but the concept, I believe, is perfectly inevitable. I mean, I think that it's absolutely inevitable that the majority of homes in a very short order will have appliances devoted in their house, devoted to serving up a virtual assistant type of interaction. And I just can't wait till it happens. I think these devices are going to be in just about every room in the house. And personally, I can't wait. I, for one, welcome our new Amazon Echo Overlords. In a nutshell. Well, another product update news, the ability in Gmail to undo send, which has existed for years as an experiment, has been promoted to an actual feature of Gmail. It's like Pinocchio, and it's a real boy now. The way it works is that after you click the send button, you have a certain amount of time, a user-controllable amount of time between 5 and 30 seconds, to change your mind and recall the email. Basically, it just doesn't send the email, and you don't actually recall it. It just sort of doesn't send it for a little while, and then it will, you know, not send it at all. I don't really get this, Joe. What's the difference between an experimental? I've been using this for, it seems like, years. You know, what's the difference between an experimental feature and a real feature?
Well, I think it depends on what company you're talking about. So if you're at Google and it says beta, it basically means this is probably big, good enough for you to use for years and years, and maybe we'll take the beta symbol off of it. If you're at Microsoft and you're beta, it's basically saying this is not ready for consumption at all.
Yeah.
Please give us some more time. And in fact, we may completely change direction. So I think the term beta is a misnomer over at Google. But to your point, in terms of this product feature, it's a little bit like using your traditional mail, and you're hoping the mailman hasn't come yet, and you're running down the block to get that piece of mail out of your mailbox before the mailman takes it.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, to your point about betas, Gmail itself was in beta for 5 years. Siri was in beta for a long time. I don't think it is anymore. But and that's uncharacteristic of Apple. Usually they say, here is a completely formed product. It's
right.
Usually not completely done when they ship the 1.0 products. But they had to do it because virtual assistants don't really work, or they work to the extent that lots of people use them and they can tweak it and give better results and so on. So they had to have that out there. And of course, you know, Gmail was perfectly good for years and years, even with the beta label. So what are you going to do? Well, in news you can use, a new iOS app called Previously On from Recap Media lets you stay in touch with your favorite TV shows, even between seasons. They give you recaps, articles, and reviews on specific episodes and social content from the cast and crew. And they do it all without spoiling any episodes for you. Joe Panettiere, I love the idea behind this app. I installed it this morning. I love it because I tend to watch shows. I'm a big fan of binge watching, so I'll binge watch, you know, House of Cards or something like that. And then there's an enormous amount of time between seasons. I kind of forget about the show.
Right.
And sometimes it comes back and I don't pay attention because I'm not reading a lot of, you know, TV content.
So you need a cliff note to bring you back into the next season, set you up. I get it. You know, it's sort of like the old 1970s TV shows where it was a to be continued and you come into part two and it gives you that 30-second recap from the previous episode.
Of Love Boat. Yeah, exactly like that.
Yeah,
although the difference is there are a lot more TV shows now and a lot more good TV shows now. And so this is really a great way to keep up with these shows, you know, Silicon Valley and all the rest. So it is a lot of fun, and I really like this app. And nobody's really writing about this yet. This news just hit this morning. Well, in news you can lose, We've told you in the past about IBM's Watson artificial intelligence technology being applied to the invention of recipes no human being would ever come up with. Recipes like Austrian chocolate burritos and Belgian baking cake. That one actually sounds pretty good. In the past, the application was available only to IBM researchers who have been apparently gaining a lot of weight. But starting today, anyone can use it. In a partnership with Bon Appetit magazine, a new Watson site lets you make weird food designed by Watson. Just go to IBMChefWatson.com and you can check it out. Some of these are weirder than others. They have even adult beverages, Joe. They have an old-fashioned that's made with chicken soup.
Good stuff. But, you know, as I hear about this, I'm reminding of two sort of groups. The first group is Thomas Watson himself, the original founder of IBM. His name, I mean, he's now basically the KFC of the IT world, I guess.
He had a big sign over his desk that said, think. And I think if he knew about this one, he would say, think again. This is weird.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then the original designers of Watson, you know, they were talking about let's do some DNA work, let's cure cancer, and oh, by the way, let's put together a cookbook.
Yeah, exactly. They even had a food truck for a while that was serving up these things. And, you know, the way Watson works is it actually looks at chemical composition of foods that are popular, and it will find those kinds of chemicals, those combinations of flavors and compounds in other foods, and it'll give you like avocado-based desserts and stuff like that, which don't make a lot of sense. Some of them, in fact, are quite nauseating, I hear, but many of them are surprisingly good. And so I guess it's a mixed bag, but this is for we tech geeks, we have to understand that this is not about chocolate burritos. This is about computers that can do creative things, that can do inventive mashup type of things, and that is something rare. Typically, computers are designed where you ask it a very specific question, and if it's very good, it will give you a very specific answer. In this case, they're saying, hey, create something, you know, and this could lead to other creative projects like, you know, paint a picture or do something else that normally we consider a human creation. So it's really fascinating technology, and we'll see how it goes. And if you create some food with IBM Watson, do one of the recipes, take a picture, send me an email to TNT@twit.tv, and so we can see that picture. I'd love to see it. So very cool. Well, our TNT fan of the day is David Foster in Bournemouth, England, who watched TNT Sunday while enjoying a giant slab of bacon, apparently. I don't know if that's an IBM Watson recipe there.
You know,
but
I was going to crack a joke about bacon and Watson and just say I'm wondering if that algorithm actually has some sort of suppression for bacon, because isn't like bacon good in everything?
I think it's quite the opposite. It is good in everything, and that's why it's in every recipe, no doubt. You know, they basically can just take anything, wrap it in bacon, and it's going to be a crowd pleaser. What are you going to do? In fact, the one of the recipes I mentioned has bacon. It's a bacon cake. I actually have a friend who baked a apple pie covered in bacon, and he actually used wild boar bacon. So anyway, long story. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT and what sort of food you're eating while watching TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. Joe Panettiere, what's going on at After Nines?
Well, Mike, as many of your listeners and viewers know, we do a podcast every Tuesday night at 9:01 p.m. Eastern at afternines.com/CEO. These are designed for IT entrepreneurs and those who are developing tech businesses. Our guest tonight is the CEO of Exablocks, Doug Brockett. He's going to be talking about scale-out storage, and that's at afternines.com/CEO, and it's at 9:01 p.m. Eastern.
Very cool. Love these previews, and congratulations on the continued success and growth of your company. It's great to see startups like this happening, and you're able to do your work on your own terms, and I love to see it. So
yeah, absolutely. Thanks. I appreciate it, Mike.
Thank you. We'll see you next week.
Absolutely. Take care. Have a good week.
You too. Well, you can subscribe to Tech News Today on your podcast app, of course, or you can choose any way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. You can watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1700 UTC at live.twit.tv. Or if you're ever in the Golden State, come on in and watch us as part of our studio audience. Just send email to tickets@twit.tv. If you'd like to help us grow our audience, here's how you can do it. Just post a link to twit.tv/TNT on your social media site, the one you like to go to, and tag as many friends as you think would enjoy the show and recommend that they subscribe to TNT. You can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/TechNewsTodayTV. And you can follow me on all the social networks at Elgan, ELGAN.com. And don't miss Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific. Tonight, Megan is off today, and I'll be hosting myself. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the Tech News Today. This show is technical, directed, and edited by Anthony Nielsen. My name is Mike Elgan. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.